Uncovering the Bronze Age, Episode 10, When Snowbirds Fall. Hello and welcome to the 10th episode of Uncovering the Bronze Age. I'm your host, Em, and this is a major milestone, one that I will admit took a lot longer to reach than I expected. This whole quarterly release schedule that I have works pretty well, since most of my podcasting energy goes into Shortbox Showcase, as well as now Dorkness to Light. But since this episode got bumped by the Wortham episode from the number 5 slot, and I wanted it to still be an important milestone number, it feels like I've been putting this episode off for about 2 years now. Of course, we still talked about plenty of interesting comics in the interim, but it all feels a little bit like filler. As always, the comments about episode 5 continue to trickle in as people either listen to it for the first time or Shag reposts it for the third or fourth time. Those comments are always appreciated. Thank you very much for enjoying that episode so much. I got a few comments more about episode 8 on All-Star Western number 10, and a sizable amount of feedback about my coverage of Tyrock's first adventure with the Legion of Colorblindness, superheroes. But unfortunately, we don't have any time for emails, because today, I am taking a look at a two-parter, the award-winning, infamous, and archetypical Bronze Age story, Snowbirds Don't Fly. This story was printed in the pages of Green Lantern and Green Arrow, issues 85 and 86, cover dated September and November, 1971. Written by the estimable Dennis O'Neill, and inked by the magnificent Dick Giordano, penciled by the incomparable Neil Adams. Our story opens on former billionaire Oliver Queen taking a late-night stroll, brooding over the turns his life has taken. Lying in wait around a corner, we see a multi-ethnic group of teenagers psyching themselves up to mug him. As he comes into range, they leap out and try to shake him down for cash. Ollie is unimpressed and, having just been dumped by Dinah, has some misplaced aggression that he would just love to let out. He gives the kids one last chance to go home before laying down the law. He easily catches the white kid's fist and tries to have a moment with him, saying that his heart clearly isn't in this fight and that he should go learn a trade, make something of himself. However, his moralizing is cut short by the Asian mugger, who has been rustling around in the background for a couple of panels and now pulls out a loaded crossbow and levels it at Ollie. He invites Ollie to keep lecturing. It'll be a laugh when he gets shot mid-platitude. Ollie tries to call the kid's bluff and dismisses the relic of a weapon. But as my dad will tell you, even a small crossbow is not a toy. With a twang and a thunk, Ollie is down for the count. The kids flee into the night as Ollie drags himself on hands and knees back to the main street. For 2 pages, he desperately seeks assistance from a wealthy couple, a taxi driver, a policeman, and finally a nurse. All of them turn away, assuming he's either drunk or stoned, seeing as his arm blocks the arrow shaft. Even the payphone is out of order. Finally, when the nurse tells him the hospital is too busy and he should come back in the morning, he simply collapses onto her desk with a quip, "Isn't modern civilization wonderful?" Having finally gotten their attention, a doctor removes the arrow and warns Ollie not to use it for a couple of weeks. Yeah, sure, Doc. He'll get right on that bed rest ASAP. Ollie inspects the arrow pulled out of his shoulder and recognizes it at once and asks to use the phone. On his way to the lobby, he tells the nurse he'll be signing up for the installment plan, a leg down and a toe every week. The lobby phone actually works, and he uses it to ring up Hal Jordan, telling him there's some economy-sized trouble in his city, and he could use the backup from Green Lantern. GL suits up and zips over, thinking to himself that Ollie was clearly trying to keep his cool, but sounded almost hysterical when he called. Once he lands in Star City, Ollie fills him in. He was shot with one of his own bolts. Not too concerning on its own, since he leaves plenty of arrows lying around at crime scenes. But he's still worried, since he hasn't seen his ward Speedy in about a month. Hal asks if he's implying Speedy may have been kidnapped, and Ollie admits it is possible. He hasn't paid much attention to the kid recently, and between his financial, romantic, and heroic troubles, he hasn't had time for much else. GL and GA start snooping around the block where Ollie was attacked, searching the seedy tenements for signs of the teens. Heading down to a rat-infested basement apartment, our heroes hear raised voices. As they turn the corner, we see the blonde mugger standing at a half-open door with the occupant. "Please, Mr. Broden, you gotta let me have some. I'm going out of my head with need. I'm begging you, on hands and knees." This Mr. Broden replies, "And that'll get you nothing but baggy pants. Scram, Junior." He kicks the door back and slams the door in the kid's face. "The way you are, you ain't even a good doormat." The boy begins pounding on the door, tears streaming from his eyes. Slowly, he drags himself away, clutching his stomach in pain. GA asks what's wrong with him, and GL explains, "Can't you see? It's withdrawal. He's gone cold turkey." To Lantern's question, GA responds, "You can be dumb sometimes. The boy is a snowbird. He's high on dope. Apparently this Broden is a salesman, a blasted pusher, and that's about as low as anyone can sink." Hearing voices on his doorstep, Broden comes back out and tells them to zip their lips and let hard-working men sleep. This will prove to have been a tactical error, as Arrow immediately shoves him back into the room and a scuffle begins. Unfortunately, Ollie's arm is still in a sling, and Broden sucker-punches him right in his injured shoulder. Ollie nearly passes out, but fortunately his backup steps in, zapping the dealer back and melting the axe he was reaching for. Hal checks in with Ollie, but he says he's doing much better than that poor sap, glancing at the teen curled up in the hallway. Hal restrains the pusher and flies all four of them to the hospital so the teenager can get some help. On the way, Arrow tells the addict, "You're really flying now, Snowbird, so sing. Tell us everything you know about Speedy." We then get a full-page interlude with the other two teenagers from the first page, as they wait in a rather lavish apartment for the last member of their crew, Chucky, to return. Now, these characters are never given names in the story, but they're actually really important and pretty well-rounded characters, and it feels reductive to just refer to them as Black Guy and Asian Guy for the next issue and a half. So I have decided the Asian teen is now named Tim, and the black teen is Gus. Tim wonders whether their friend was able to get a score, but Gus says Broden wouldn't sell to his granny unless there was bread up front. A third teenager sitting in the corner tells them to relax, and asks about all the medieval weapons hanging up on the wall. Tim says, "My pop's collection. All day he answers to chink, slant. At night he comes home and grooves on the armament, pretends he's Genghis Khan or somebody, pretends he's killing his bosses instead of kissing their feet. Pop's escape trip." Gus chimes in, "Oh, you coming on strong. So you get insulted. Hey, chink's nothing compared to the names I'm called. Nick is for openers." Then they get real poetic. "But it ain't the names they call you. It's what's behind their eyes, baby. That's my reason for shooting. It makes life more bearable. It gets me through the day." Tim winces. The cramps are getting worse. Hopefully Chucky gets back soon. Gus asks the third teenager, "You got a reason for being a hophead, Roy?" And Speedy replies, "It's personal." Just then, an ominous radioactive-looking blob begins to phase through the ceiling, and I realize how much the Green Lantern powers look like a drug trip gone wrong to begin with. Gus is actually relatively unfazed, saying that the narco squad is getting creative with their busts. As the teens turn to flee, GL sends out tendrils of energy from his ring to encase their hands and feet, and says, "Hold on, we mean you no harm." Gus snaps back, "Yeah, and the street's made of pistachio ice cream, pigs." GA shoots back that he has a quick lip. Maybe they should chuck the pair of them in jail anyway. Roy steps into panel and asks if Ollie's going to do the same to him. Green Arrow is, actually, totally unsurprised to find his ward hanging out with these junkies. When he dropped off the grid, Ollie knew he had to be playing undercover agent, on the trail of some serious bad guys. Roy goes along with his mentor's assumption, but claims he hasn't been able to find the big boss yet. Tim cuts in and says he can take our heroes right to the head of the organization. He doesn't dig the habit, and he wants to see the pushers behind bars for what they did to him. Ollie notices Roy looking a little pale and tells him he doesn't have to come along. He's done enough for one night. Roy agrees and turns away, as Green Arrow is beamed up with everyone else, leaving Roy behind. Again. On the flight over to the airfield that serves as the base of operation for the drug dealers, Tim asks how GL and GA found them. Gus says, why bother asking? Chucky obviously ratted on them. He's white, after all, especially that lily-white liver. Ollie is still seething, and Hal tries to rein him in. Steady, Arrow. You don't have to be so rough on the lads. Oh, buzz off, Lantern. Look, sure I'm ticked off at the pushers because they prey on weakness. But that doesn't mean my heart bleeds for junkies. Life is tough for everyone. If you want to claim humanity, you don't climb into a drug stupor to deal with your problems. Tim cuts in. If you're done preaching, I heard Broden say this is where he meets his supplier. The four sneak silently into the hangar and overhear two men counting their profits and laughing at their customers. Like taking candy from a baby. The poor dogs will pay any price for a jolt. We got supply, and boy, they've got demand. As our heroes step out of the shadows, the dealers reach for their guns, but Hal melts their barrels shut with two focused bolts of energy. As they congratulate themselves for taking down the bad guys so easily, they are taken down themselves. Tim grabs a wrench and clocks Green Lantern in the back of the head, then catches Green Arrow by his one good arm. Gus and the two dealers leap on him and beat him into unconsciousness. One of the dealers wants to just bash their brains in, but the other one has a flair for the dramatic. Any of that product left? Pure merchandise, not cut with talcum like the stuff we sold. As he shoots Green Lantern up with pure heroin, he tells his partner, "You do the other one, while I be a good citizen and phone my friendly neighborhood policeman. The cops will find these crusaders high on junk, and they'll figure they ripped open our organization, plus discrediting the do-gooders." Gus is starting to feel a little hesitant at this point, and Tim asks if his friend is getting cold feet. He says he doesn't want anyone to get busted, but as Tim points out, better them than us. Everyone gets ready to split before the cops show up, and to show their appreciation, the dealers toss a packet to each of the boys and tells them, live big. As the cops arrive, someone points them in the direction of a bunch of dope fiends tearing up the office, then ducks into the darkened hangar. It's Roy, who starts slapping Green Lantern in the face repeatedly, trying to get him to snap out of his drug-induced stupor. Using some reverse psychology, Roy bets that Hal can't even use his ring, and a very woozy Lantern decides to prove him wrong. This will generally be considered a bad move, since all of us know not to trip and fly. Hal's ring conjures a trippy-ass, 30-foot-tall, monstrous, slavering version of himself, which immediately grabs all three of them and prepares to consume them. Hal, sweating bullets, focuses his will in a single concerted effort. He'll be a man, no monster. He will be free of this thing. He bubbles himself, Ollie, and Roy, and rockets away from the monster as fast as possible. Roy says, nice going, but Hal needs absolute silence. One distraction, and they're going to fall. Back at Ollie's pad, GL and GA are experiencing a wicked come down, but fortunately Roy is there to nurse them through it. Holding his head in his hands, Hal asks, why do people use that stuff? Ollie can't believe how badly that turned out. They lost the bad guys, and the evidence, and got suckered by a pair of junkies. If Speedy hadn't deduced where those punks were taking them, the law would have heaved the pair of them in the clink and thrown away the key. Hal is still trying to wrap his head around the appeal of drugs, and Speedy says maybe he can throw some light on a reason. Say a young cat has someone he respects, looks up to, an older man. And say the man leaves, chases around the country, gets involved with others, and ignores his young friend, then the guy might need a substitute for friendship. He might seek it in junk. As Ollie prepares to walk Hal out to the street, he jokes at Speedy, "Gee, all that tail lacks is violin music. I'm touched. My stomach is, anyway. Because every time I hear a sob story, I almost lose my lunch." He tells Hal he's welcome to spend the night on the couch, but Hal thinks that he's pretty sure he can get home in one piece. He'll sleep in his own bed, and tomorrow, they'll get back to chasing down those creeps. Green Arrow agrees, and we see Lantern taking off, flying over the city skyline, as in the shadows, a shady deal is going down. Returning to the apartment, Ollie calls out, "I'm gonna cook some of my special scorch-your-mouth chili. Can I interest you in a bowl, Speedy?" But when he enters the bedroom, "Oh, God! Speedy! You're really a junkie!"
"Well, who did you think I was talking about?"
It doesn't end yet. It can't. Next issue. The most shattering conclusion ever. And we'll continue our coverage by looking at that shattering conclusion. They say it'll kill me, but they won't say when. Right after this promo.
Hello, ladies. Listen to your man. Now listen to me. Now listen to your man. Now listen to me. Sadly, he isn't me. But if he stopped downloading lame-ass podcasts and switched to Two True Freaks, he could learn to sound like me. Look down. Back up. Where are you? You're on the Enterprise with a man your man could sound like. What's in your hand? Back at me. I have it. It's a long box filled with comics that you love. Look again. The comics are now episodes. Anything is possible when your man listens to Two True Freaks and not lame asses. I'm on a tauntaun.
Issue 86 begins with a full-page shot of Green Arrow bitch-slapping Roy away from his needle as he erupts into hot fury. "You're a lousy junkie! No better than the rest of those sniveling punks!" As he hits the floor, Roy taunts him. "If that's the way you see it, go ahead. Hit me. Want to do it again? Or have you proven to yourself you're stronger than us weaklings? A big man like you doesn't need drugs, does he? You get high on your own self-righteousness." Green Arrow tells his ward to get out, and Roy says that's no problem. He was already going. We see a close-up on GA's face as his internal monologue kicks in. "Was it me? Did I somehow fail the kid? I haven't paid much attention to him lately. But he shouldn't need attention, not at his age. No, I'm innocent of blame. I've always taught him to be strong, independent, to hang tough." And the Mentor of the Year award goes to Oliver Queen, ladies and gentlemen. Refocusing his rage on the pushers who did this to Roy, Ollie hits the streets to make them pay. But while his apartment is unoccupied, Tim and Gus break in, looking for Speedy, eager to share their score. They see evidence of a scuffle and find Speedy's works. They decide not to bother waiting for him. According to Gus, "Pass a chance, you'll always be one behind." Tim fixes the doses, having to guess since he's never used uncut heroin before. He goes first, his face scrunching up in a mix of pain and pleasure. "Don't need food. Don't need girls. Just old mama spike into the main line." Gus checks in with him, but Tim says he's fine. More than fine. Nice and tingly. A fire running through him. "Dig it. I'm so far up. I'm nowhere." Tim collapses face first onto the floor. Gus rolls his buddy over, but there's nothing he can do. "Oh my God! He overdosed! He's dead!" Panic-stricken, Gus bolts for the door, leaving a corpse in his wake. Back in Hal's hotel room, he mulls over what Speedy said at the end of the last issue. Something about the way he looked when he was explaining why youngsters turn to drugs. "Might as well face it. I'm not going to get any sleep at this rate." He recites the oath, and Green Lantern flies off to speak with Roy. But when he arrives, he can't find either of his friends, but instead discovers the body of a kid who almost got him killed. Desperate to regroup, he takes off into the sky in search of Ollie and Roy. Green Arrow starts his investigation in the last place he had the drug dealer's trail, the airplane hangar. As he searches for clues, he is discovered by one of the henchmen. G.A. kicks the gun away from him, then subdues the man with a punch to the solar plexus. The goon gives up the information. The boss lives on a boat. It's at Pier 16 on the South Shore Marina. G.A. says he'd better be telling the truth. But once our hero leaves to follow the intel, we see the henchman call someone and report. He fell for it like a ton of bricks. The boss, or all we can see of him, a silk cravat, replies, "I thought one of those snoopers might be back. You've done well. There will be an extra $1,000 in your pay envelope." Elsewhere in the city, Hal feels like he's going in circles. With no other clues, he heads back towards Chinatown, which was where they busted the teens from the previous issue. Maybe he'll get lucky twice. As soon as he touches down, he hears moans coming from an alley. Passed out next to some garbage cans, he finds Speedy. When asked if he's all right, Roy says, "Guts on fire. Chills. Hands shaking. Yeah, I'm in great shape." Hal asks what happened to him, and Speedy reiterates, "What's wrong is I'm a rotten junkie. I need a fix. Came to Chinatown, can't remember why. Mind's all muddled." Hal offers to fly him to the hospital, but Roy insists, "No! I'm gonna kick habit by myself. Prove to my high and mighty guardian I'm strong as he is. Then, gonna laugh in his face." Hal doesn't think that that's a medically advisable idea, but at the very least, he doesn't think Speedy should be alone. "I'll take you to Dinah Lance's place. My guardian's lovey-dovey girlfriend, huh? Well, I don't care. Though she might." On the flight over, Hal asks Roy how it all started. "Curiosity, I guess. I'd heard about these great kicks." "Didn't you realize the danger? I had the sermons thrown at me. But Lantern, your generation's been known to lie, dig it? You've told us war is fun and skin color's important. A man's worth is the size of his bank account. All crocs. Why should we believe you about your drug rap?" Hal says, "I wish I could answer you, but anything I say would be a crock." As they land on Dinah's doorstep, Hal asks, "At least did your crime busting do any good?" And Speedy says, "Sure. The big importer operates from a yacht moored somewhere on the south side, a boat called the Lady Billy." Dinah opens the door, surprised by her late visitors, but Hal just says, "Speedy needs a place to stay the night. He'll explain why." "Right. Lady, get ready for a sob story." Meanwhile, at a millionaire's haunt on a very restricted stretch of the oceanfront, G.A. thinks, "Pier 16, but the only boat I see is big as a destroyer, and judging from the music and laughter coming from it, there's a whale of a bash going on." A guard approaches Ollie and asks for a light, but Green Arrow recognizes him. "You're one of those dope dealers. Go to the head of the class. Hit him." Though the Emerald Archer instinctively ducks, the shadowy goon wielding a pipe standing behind him still manages to catch him in the shoulder. That thing is really taking a beating this story. Ollie taunts them on the odds, 4 arms versus 1, but he does still manage to hold his own. It takes a full page of chokeholds, throws, and cheap shots to subdue Green Arrow. The boss congratulates his men on a job well done, though still we can only see his cravat, cigarette, and a bit of blonde hair. They ask if they should just put a slug in the snoop, but the boss says not until the yacht sets off. Send him for a swim instead. A bimbo in a revealing pink jumpsuit leans out of the door and calls for her darling Solomon to return. The party was a dreadful bore without him. The man apologizes. "A small business trifle, Angie. All finished. Now be a lamb and get me a drink." Solomon mingles with his guests, socialites, senators, and judges. One of them ropes him into a conversation as he passes. "We've been discussing these young people, Hooper. These filthy, dope-swilling beatniks." And the drug lord nods along sympathetically. "Yes, I must confess, I can't understand the attraction. So destructive, eh?" As the Lady Billy sets sail for a more tropical clime, the goons decide what to do with our unconscious hero. Back in the days, they'd have given someone a cement overcoat. They were real class back in the old days. but they suppose a rusted anchor will have to do. As he hits the freezing water, Ollie is shocked awake just in time to be dragged into the deeps. Using an acetylene arrow, he burns through the chain and kicks desperately for the surface, convinced he'll never make it. He crests the surface just as Hal arrives, and subdues the attempted muggers with two giant ring construct gorillas. Because DC Comics. After a quick blow-dry, again courtesy of Hal's ring, Ollie is his usual self, but when he asks how GL found him so quickly, Speedy put me on the trail. I simply searched the area. It's none of my business, but Arrow, the kid needs help. Bad. In a near wordless 9-panel grid, we see inside the home of Dinah Lance. Speedy is slumped against the wall, clutching his knee to his chest in a desperate attempt to control his shaking. Dinah reaches out to him, but he slaps her away. In one panel, he bites down on his own hand, tears streaming from his eyes. In another, he douses his head in cold water. And finally, when his energy is all but spent, he lets Dinah hold him. The night is long, full of a boy's pain and a woman's pity. The next morning, somewhere in the Caribbean, Solomon Hooper's party boat pulls into dock so he can do legitimate business. He greets the policeman on the dock and walks into his company, Hooper Pharmaceuticals. Inside, he meets with the professor, the Walter White of this story, who has just finished synthesizing the latest batch of dope. He asks if it isn't dangerous to carry the product himself, but Hooper just laughs. "I am a most reputable member of the international community. No crass policeman would dare suspect me, the chap who entertains senators, judges." At that moment, Green Lantern bursts through the window. Once getting their asses kicked by spectral apes, Hooper's goons from the dock were more than willing to talk. "You've had a nifty career, haven't you? Wallowing in luxury while your victims suffered and ended their wretched existence on slabs? Well, it's over. Your senator friends will turn on you, and your pet judges will sentence you." Of course, no hard-traveling hero would bust a place without backup. In this case, it takes the form of Green Arrow, weapon drawn, holding back the arrow in his teeth. He fires at the heroin-filled container, shattering it. The professor has nowhere to go, but Solomon attempts to escape through a window. Green Lantern catches him by the collar, throwing him back into the room. Solomon lunges at him. "You asked for this, fool. I happen to be..." Hal cuts him off. "Happen to be intercollegiate boxing champ. I've heard. A million times on the Late Show." Green Arrow catches his opponent in midair, hurling him bodily into the lab, scattering beakers and instruments in all directions. GA checks on the unconscious Hooper and says that they'd better call a doctor. Hal replies, "Given all the pain he's caused, he doesn't exactly feel terribly bad if Hooper hurts." Back in Star City, a week later, we bear witness to Tim's funeral. The priest tries to comfort his mother, Mrs. Sue, as they close the coffin's lid on her child. Hal and Ollie, in their civilian threads, watch from a respectful distance away. Hal takes some comfort that at least they caught Tim's murderers, but Ollie has a different perspective. "Hooray for us, we squashed one worm. How many others are infesting this stinking world, peddling misery? I tell you, Lantern, sometimes I despair." A voice from off-panel says, "Don't." And when Ollie turns to look behind him, Speedy! "Hello, Oliver. You might be interested in knowing that I beat my... habit. I'm myself again." Ollie goes to clap him on the shoulder, but Roy brushes him off. "Don't give me that good boy bull. I only made it with some help from my friends, Hal and Dinah, when you turned your back on me." Hal says that's not fair to Ollie, and Roy begrudgingly agrees. "No, I guess it isn't. You did a lot to inspire me to go cold turkey. I should show my appreciation." And at last, Oliver receives some consequences for his actions. Rubbing his jaw, he asks what that sucker punch was for, and Roy retorts, "Call it sharing. I'm sharing a little piece of the pain I've gone through these past few days. The kind of pain thousands of kids are going through every day, because an uncaring and unthinking society turns its back on them. Drugs are a symptom, and you, like the rest of society, attack the symptom, not the disease. And this symptom is worse than most. It maims, it pains, it dims you, it drives you to the edge of insanity and over, and one day, ends your trip in the morgue. Having delivered a pretty great mic drop, Roy makes his exit. Dinah tries to stop him, and he thanks her for the helping hand, but says, now Ollie needs her more. He just doesn't know it. He's kinda dumb. In a lot of ways. I'm a lot like him. I'm cocky enough to think I can help some of my friends avoid that slab. See you straights around. As Ollie watches Roy walk away with a sense of purpose, a very large lump of pride forms in the throat of Oliver Queen, as his boy becomes a man. And that concludes our story. We'll take one more quick promo break, then reconvene to discuss the themes of Snowbirds, how well it stands up to scrutiny, and what this story meant for Roy Harper and heralded for the DC Universe to come.
To tell you the story of Green Lantern is to tell you the story of the birth of a universe, the origins of DC as a whole.
It's a magic emerald meteor from space in the 1940s.
It's the establishment of the JSA.
It's the birth of the Silver Age.
It's the introduction of a universal police force.
It's the formation of the JLA.
It's the emergence of the multiverse.
It's a crisis in both space and time.
It's an emerald dawn.
And it's an emerald twilight.
It's the brightest day.
And the blackest night.
And the Lantern Cast covers all of this and everything in between. We're Green Lantern's greatest advocates and fiercest critics. We've been fans for years, and it's the reason we're self-proclaimed Lanternologists.
So find us on iTunes and Stitcher, and give us a listen. Because the history of Green Lantern really is the history of the DC Universe. And we've got the interviews, commentaries, reviews, and more to back it up.
I was a little intimidated by the idea of covering this story, which I think is part of why I kept putting it off. The cover of this first issue is so well known that it borders on meme status, as it proclaims, DC attacks youth's greatest problem, drugs. The story itself holds up quite well, considering the fact that it is 45 years old, but some elements do border on the cheesy. In issue 86, when Gus realizes his friend is dead, the background decides to ram home the trippiness with a neon-radiating amoeba behind him that looks vaguely like a hand reaching out. And I don't know, maybe in the 70s this would have had some more emotional power. But looking at this now, I just think, wow, this sure was from the 70s. But that mostly comes down to the coloring choices. Neil Adams' pencils are very dynamic, and he makes a great use of space, particularly his 9-panel dialogue light pages. There are two of those in particular, one in issue 85, when Ollie is trying to get help after he's been shot, and issue 86, when Roy is going through withdrawal. The page where Hal finds Roy collapsed in an alley in issue 86 is also noteworthy. There's an ethereal outline of Green Lantern's head that's superimposed over this page, so that when you read it, you first see his internal monologue as he's looking around the city, and then sort of within the outline of his profile, you see the page laid out with the conversation he has with Roy. And all of the coloring, as a result, is done in shades of green, which gives this talk a really surreal feeling. All of these pages convey a ton of emotion very effectively and help give some oomph to the social commentary. Speaking of which, this story has a very strong message, but I definitely wouldn't consider it a PSA comic. That was my number one fear, especially with the cover copy about a very important message from the mayor of New York and the shocking truth about drugs. This could have veered into full Reefer Madness territory. However, the characters help to keep this grounded, and I don't mean the title heroes or even Speedy. In the recap, for the sake of brevity, I gave the two young drug addicts names, but I'm actually glad that neither one of them are named characters in the story. Their function is to represent all of the anonymous victims of drug abuse. And I'm also glad there isn't any retroactive baggage connected to their characters. Let's not forget the next issue would introduce the first black DC superhero who was very nearly named Jefferson Lincoln. But the fact that these two are anonymous doesn't make them any less compelling as characters. All of the teenagers, even Chucky, who only appears on a handful of pages, are sympathetic and engaging. I love the scene in issue 85, where they talk about their reasons for shooting up, and Tim and Gus both say it's to deal with racism. They are each able to pull from the experiences of being Asian American or African American and discuss those independently, but it doesn't feel like tokenism. The word I'm going to keep coming back to is genuine. Their talks with each other read very genuinely, and when they're talking about the life experiences of people that they know, it reads true. Particularly Gus's line about, "It's not the words they call you, it's the look behind their eyes." Denny O'Neill clearly actually did his research and talked to non-white people about their experiences. Then later, in issue 86, I really love Roy's scene, where he takes the adults to task about why teenagers don't trust them. He brings up war and racism and greed, and his spiel reads very honest. It's brimming with teenage self-assurance and angst, but he makes really good points. I like that the teenagers still read occasionally a little dumb or naive or full of themselves. But the writing still supports their points, that they are making good points and calling out hypocrisy, even if they're not necessarily doing it in the best way possible. Finally, at the end of part two, when Roy delivers his final "drugs are terrible" speech, you buy it, because you've seen him deal with his addiction firsthand, and he always keeps the focus firmly on the social factors that drive someone to drugs and the lack of support for addicts after the fact. I also like the, well, not quite subtle moments, but maybe more thought-out moments, like the judge who openly connects the dot between demonizing drug addicts and demonizing hippies, or the fact that the big, big bad of this story runs a pharmaceutical company. Structurally, this story starts with junkie muggers in an alley and follows that train all the way back to Big Pharma. Though this story was technically approved by the Comics Code, it's clear that the CCA wasn't actually reading any of the books sent to them. The means of drug use is very frankly presented, and I think that it's that lack of coyness that helps to connect to the characters. Everyone is very human. Well, except for the ex-mafia goons and the big bad evil CEO. I mean, it's still a comic book, and we need some comic book villainy. Now let's talk about Roy Harper's tragic little life. The Teen Titans book was going through some pretty serious growing pains. This was pre-Wolfman Perez, and the book was doing its best to stay kind of relevant, with one issue about inner-city racism and another about the death of an anti-war activist, but the book had largely stagnated, still very much retaining its original premise of the sidekick superhero clubhouse feel. They tried adding some new characters or trying to spice up different situations, but nothing was really sticking. Roy Harper was also going through some personal turmoil. He broke up with his girlfriend and teammate Donna Troy, and then it's implied when Ollie lost his fortune, Roy also lost his financial support. His basic needs were likely still being met, but with Ollie off gallivanting across the country, Roy felt the need to grow up pretty quickly. Some people have accused this storyline of coming out of nowhere, but one, that's kind of the point, and two, it actually makes sense given Roy's emotional state. In the Batman books of the time, which we looked at back in episode 2, Dick Grayson had gone to college. But that was really the only sign of a sidekick character growing up. This story did a great job of showing that ugly side of growing up, particularly the resentment that could build from living in the shadow of another hero during those difficult years. Now, I love Roy Harper, but if they were going to tell this story with anyone, it sort of had to be him. Dick Grayson was too well known, too beloved, too popular, and frankly, Bruce Wayne is a very involved and caring mentor, not to mention the world's greatest detective. Wally West could have been an option, but with his connections to the Speed Force, a bad trip could have become devastatingly destructive and was definitely a different story than the one Denny O'Neil wanted to tell. With Green Arrow's focus on street-level crime, and Roy's status as a founding member of the Titans, it just kind of makes sense. Sometimes people complain that pulling a dark twist like this is lazy, but when you consider the number one method of reinterpreting a character to shake up their status quo is murder, I'm looking at you, Jason, Damian, Jean Grey, then drug addiction is definitely a better option. And possibly one of the best things that ever happened to Roy Harper. It sets him aside from the other sidekicks and ex-sidekicks, and either his addiction, recovery, or struggle to stay clean can serve as conflict for new stories. Of course, like any aspect of a character's history, this can be horrifically abused, cry for justice, but for the most part, I think that it added a depth to Roy Harper as a character that we hadn't seen before, and would really set the stage for him to grow into a cool, nuanced, independent character with his own goals and aspirations separate from that of his original mentor. Also, Leon Harper is adorable, and who knows if his story would have ever gone in that direction, except for this sharp right turn right here. Now, I've gone on and on about how sympathetic the teen characters are and how you really identify with them. The counterpoint of this is that our titular heroes come off pretty poorly in this story, and Oliver is written as a complete jackass. Now, again, this is not necessarily a criticism. I love Ollie Queen, but I can admit that he is kind of dumb and really self-righteous. So having another character call him out on his hypocrisy and his liberal tendencies that are untempered by sympathy actually works pretty well for the story. Hal, on the other hand, is just a sort of impotent figure as far as dealing with Roy's problem goes. He's completely blindsided by this revelation, even though really obvious hints have been dropped to him for an issue and about a quarter, that when he finds Roy, he has no idea what's going on, because in his mind, that could never happen to anyone I know. Drug addiction is a thing that happens to junkies, not people close to me. He wouldn't even know how to start looking for the signs. This means the biggest thing that Roy has to do for Hal is educate him, whereas Ollie knows about drug addiction, but like I said, has no sympathy or compassion or willingness to understand people who struggle with addiction. He is very quick to write it off as moral weakness. And I think my one problem with the story structure is that Oliver doesn't ever quite have a point where he fully gets it. Now, on the last page, after Roy punches him right in the kisser, beautiful. It says he has this moment of pride, and he sort of like sheds a few tears because Roy is growing up and his boy has become a man. But at no point does Oliver ever really have a moment of self-reflection or take responsibility for his role in driving Roy away. Now, again, as far as the story that Denny O'Neil wants to tell, that works. Because what it does is drive a really sharp wedge between Roy and Oliver for years that, as far as I can tell, wouldn't really be resolved until the birth of Leon. The whole point of this story is that there's not really a happy ending. I mean, for God's sakes, it takes place at a funeral. But I suppose if there was one thing that I would change in this whole story, it's allowing Roy a way to go home, that not driving this sharp wedge between himself and Oliver the way that he did. I just think that Roy Harper deserves a little bit of happiness now and then. But, after all, this is the beginning of the Bronze Age. This is the start of more serious stories, bigger consequences for our heroes, having to deal with the results of their actions. This story would set the stage for things like the death of Jason Todd. No one is immune in these stories. But that's all years into the future. For now, Snowbirds Don't Fly is simply a standout two-part comic story which sent out massive ripples throughout the comics reading world and pushed the boundaries as far as the types of stories comic creators would be able to tell in this medium. Though this is an excellent and important story, I still think that Batman 232, which we talked about in episode 2, is still my watermark book for quality. Snowbirds Don't Fly, though very, very good, still had some questionable 70s writing, and our two main characters are made rather unlikable for the purpose of plot. However, I still rate it very highly. I definitely, I suppose you can say, enjoyed this story. It was a good read, and it was very moving. So now, having covered the story that everyone was waiting for me to take a look at, what's next for the podcast? Well, I'm not really sure. I've covered most of my bases, I hope. So if you have any suggestions for issues or characters that you really think that I should talk about, feel free to let me know. I have a few options on the table. I think now that I've talked about another important story, I might try and look at something that's a little more throwaway or out there, or just plain kind of weird. I haven't settled on a particular issue yet, so you'll just have to wait and see next episode what book I'm taking a look at. Until next time, take care. This has been a Relatively Geeky production. Tune in to the Relatively Geeky podcast feed for this and our other shows, Shortbox Showcase and the Quarterbin Podcast, at www.relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com, or search for Relatively Geeky or Uncovering the Bronze Age in iTunes. If you have feedback for this or any of our other shows, email us at relativelygeeky@gmail.com. or leave a rating or review on iTunes. The intro music for this episode was Comfortably Numb by Pink Floyd, and the closing music was, well, you know. We've known each other.